Ain't no one gonna break my stroke. Ain't no one gonna eat my tendies. No, on the podcast known as
Trapped Under Plastic. The podcast that's brush looking good.
Thank you for that intro, Aiton. John, how you doing, buddy?
Woo! You know, I love me a good KFC reference.
Anything related to finger looking good fried chicken is always a good reference.
Yeah, you know, the Colonel, he knew what's the what. I'm doing okay. Life's good. We're up recording on a slightly different date, and a little earlier than usual. I kind of downplayed how much worse the traffic would be driving up exactly when everyone's going to work in the Twin Cities.
So you like left it an earlier time, but didn't. I mean, you got here earlier, but not as early as I thought you would get here because you ran into some heavier traffic.
Yeah, I was leaving my daughter at the bus stop at 7:15, and it took me almost an hour and 45 minutes to get here. And it usually takes me like 1:15.
That's not nice.
But that's neither here nor there nor everywhere. We have some preamble ramble.
We have a stacked preamble ramble. Yeah, and I am contributing heavily to the stacked preamble ramble because a lot has gone on the last 2 weeks.
Per usual, 24 hours before the podcast, it looks like we have nothing to talk about.
And
by the time we sit in these seats,
three-hour episode,
it's just like, son of a bitch, where did all that come from?
It's a lot. There's a lot going on.
Yeah. Okay, so why don't you kick us off a little rambly-bambly?
I will. So I played Shatterpoint. Recently, Curtis took an interest in Shatterpoint, even though he doesn't like Star Wars at all. And it kind of reminded me of A Song of Ice and Fire, because I don't really care about Game of Thrones at all. And Curtis is like, let's play that. I love the show. And then I tried it out, and I loved the game. And now I love Star Wars, and I wanted to play with Curtis. And he was showing some interest. He was like, let's try it out. And so we played a game on stream, like both of our actual first full game. We both played a demo of like one-third of the game, because the game is broken up into 2 to 3 struggles. But we never played a full one. So we played a full one, and, you know, it's got some problems. The rule book is probably the biggest problem. But the game is very enjoyable. I will go on record saying that Guild Ball is alive and well in Shatterpoint.
Oh, wow.
Which, if you know anything about me, I really enjoy Guild Ball, and I am really enjoying Shatterpoint.
So it's Guild Ball minus the balls plus the lightsabers.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, that should have been their marketing.
Yeah, that would have gone very far. Not leaning into Star Wars. Yeah.
No. I want to see the quick demo of like a dude running down the pitch. This is like crappy animation. He's kicking the ball, and the ball's going, and it changes direction of the camera, and then shoosh, the ball is cut in half by a lightsaber.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not dead. Do, 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 do.
That'd have been an ad that appealed to specifically me. But it's really good. I was listening to the Rule of Carnage podcast, which is run by Jim Hutchinson and another guy. If you don't know Jim, he makes Gaslands and also A Billion Suns. And one thing he mentioned about war games was that you can really learn a lot about a war game based on asking this question. How difficult is it for a unit in your game to start on one side of the battlefield and make it to the other side of the battlefield? Right?
Oh, interesting.
So movement is such a huge part of war games. It really is like where a lot of the interest comes from. And that question implies something about your game, not that it's good or bad, but in Shatterpoint, it's relatively easy to make it pretty far across the entire battlefield in a single mouse activation. Now, depending on the model, depending on like supporting units, stuff like that, it might change, but it felt so good to play that game and be where I needed to be, not feel like things were getting in my way of accomplishing what I wanted to accomplish. I lost, but it was still super close and felt really great. I don't know. It was really enjoyable. I liked it a lot, and I would encourage you guys to check it out if you are able to.
It kind of seems like that's probably an intrinsic part of the rule system is, like, if it takes a long time for your Jedi to get into all the people that are shooting a bunch of blasters at them, then suddenly your whole rule set of wounding and damaging and abilities is totally different,
yeah.
Right? Because it's like, yeah, actually, it's just better to run a whole bunch of stormtroopers that just shoot the shit out of them before they get there, and then by sheer weight of dice, the Jedi's much less powerful because he's getting blown up before he gets there. But if they can move, they can pew across there, then suddenly it kind of takes the power of the shooting away.
Absolutely. Cool. Absolutely. So yeah, it's really good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. Like not a single model in my squads or Curtis's squads died in the entire game. And that might sound like a problem in a, you know, war game. But it wasn't a problem. Like, you can still wound models, which is not the same as killing them outright, and that has a ton of strategic value. It felt good to have your models and be able to play with them. No models ever, like, stuck together like glue and kept bashing each other's brains out. We were constantly moving around the map because...
That's so cool. Yeah. You can do that. You don't get stuck in forever.
Yeah, and just to briefly explain how killing someone works in Shatterpoint, you have a health amount and a durability amount. As soon as you've taken all the damage that equals your health amount, you gain a wounded token, and you can no longer take any more damage. So it becomes not valuable to keep hitting someone. So just because of that one, like, admittedly unrealistic change to how actual life works, it makes you move around because you don't want to hit someone and it not be valuable. But it also means that you can keep playing with your models. So then when it comes back to activating that one person, you take that wounded token and it turns into a durability wound. And as soon as you get 2 durability or 3 durability wounds, then the model is removed entirely. But as these natural moments when it's like, okay, I've done 1/2 of this model's health, I'm going to stop because there's no more gameplay value in hitting it again. I'm going to move somewhere else. I'm going to get objectives. I'm going to kill something else. And so there's tons of movement happening. Even if it's forced, it still felt really good. Okay, I'll be done.
Okay. No, that's that. I'm excited. That's cool.
Yeah.
I like this. The scale of the models seem really nice, too.
Yeah, yeah. And I'll show you the Grand Inquisitor that I painted because I've been hyped about it recently.
Yeah, that's a nice... It's the scale that something we'll talk about a little bit later in what I painted in Kingdom Death, how that's kind of scale crept to now be closer to that than it is to your Blood Knights.
Interesting.
First thing I want to talk about in the preamble ramble is CoolieCon.
Ooh.
CoolieCon took place a couple of weekends ago in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's a nice, intimate little convention, although it's growing each year. They said this is their largest number, and they had the largest number of entries in their painting competition. So that was exciting. There was probably 60 maybe entries for a small convention and not a major city.
Yeah.
It was pretty nice.
That's
and it's
bad.
Also it's a convention that focuses on like tabletop RPGs, tabletop board games, tabletop card games, and tabletop miniature games. There's a 40K and an Age of Sigmar tournament going on there too.
Mm-hmm.
We were there. They have a massive silent auction. That's one of the coolest things there, where people, because it is a charity that they donate a bunch of money to wonderful causes, and people can donate, and these stores donate, and all this stuff, things for their silent auction. And so there's all sorts of really awesome things. You just spend time walking down the aisles. It's like the best garage sale for nerds in the world. So yeah, that was really cool. I have a present for you from James.
Oh, thank you, James.
Yeah.
I have a question about conventions. Do they naturally lend themselves to being charity events?
I think so.
Okay, because I know of at least 3 cons that are charity events also.
Mm-hmm.
So I just didn't know if that was like a natural thing.
Yeah, I think it just kind of, it works really well. It's kind of the spirit of what a convention is bringing everyone together for the thing that they're passionate about, thing that they love.
Mm.
Something about like doing that for corporate greed to make the most money off of the people feels a little sketchy. Maybe giving it to a good cause. Maybe it's aligned with what the passions of your running crew is. It's a good thing. Anyway,
okay.
James runs a booth at CoolieCon and sells some of his 2D art. And he had a new series of prints that he brought out. And I got to see the originals, and they were awesome. And I got one.
You got an original?
Not an original. Oh,
okay,
no.
Okay.
No. I think he had the originals for sale, but they were too expensive for my blood. But he was nice enough to gift us prints. So I got one. Sexy Teeth Joshy got one. And then the third one of this series is for you. And I think it fits our aesthetic pretty well. And
I don't know if it's going to be Tendy or a vampire right now. It could be either one.
And I picked the one for you. It worked out well. Joshy got to pick first because I wasn't even around. James over here giving away shit to Sexy Teeth Joshy before I even knew we were getting shit. God damn it. But then of the other, which it worked out well because I think one of the three was my favorite. One of the three I think you would like the most. And then Josh picked the third one anyway. Because Josh, you know, it just worked out. So here is the print.
Ooh, a rusty skeleton boy.
Standing in a green field.
Yeah, dude. This is definitely a bit of me.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah. Is this watercolor?
Yes.
We'll have a picture of it on the screen right now so you can see it in better detail.
I didn't bring mine because I'm a terrible podcaster. mine is also laying in a green field, like leaned up against a stump, is a dead skeleton holding, also in the similar armor, holding up like a rusty spear. It's like it's lying there, and there's like a pretty little bird that's perched on the top of the spear.
Yeah, I really do like this. And I could like... Whenever I see art like this, I'm like, oh, like what could I hire this person to do that would like the entire rule book would like be like this aesthetic or something like that? Because this is so cool. I love this. Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah. So James is a wonderful guy. He is the one that he brought us the big box of snacks last time with the Scotcheroos.
Oh, yeah.
Big fan of the podcast. So also there, they invited us. You had a unfortunate schedule conflict, although we were both planning on going, or we weren't clarified on when the judging would take place, but we were allowed to present and judge the Trapped Under Plastic Award.
Our Choice Award.
Tup Choice Award. And the choice by Tup Choice, it means John's choice.
Yeah, we were planning on going on Sunday, but then what we didn't realize was that the painting competition was on Saturday, and I was hanging out with my family.
You were way over in eastern Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So time didn't work. But it all worked out. I was thinking I was still going to go on Sunday. I was able to work it where I could go on Saturday afternoon with Sexy T, Joshy, and Ginger Jesus. And we showed up. I spent probably close to an hour looking at over all the minis, picking them up, licking them, making sure that
gamer sweat.
Yeah. And I didn't actually work with any of the regular judges. So I didn't know if my Tup Choice Award was also going to go to someone that was going to win a different award.
Yeah, so what was your choosing, like, rubric? Were you going for style points? Were you going for something that John would like? Were you going for, like, actual artful? Was it, like, a combination of those things? What made you choose what you chose?
That's a good question. The big thing for me is what I did was I walked around all the tables, and I wanted to see at a 5-foot distance what drew me in. So that was the first thing.
Sure, sure.
If it was technically painted really, really well, but it didn't make me at 5 feet away go like, ooh, what's that? Plenty of those won awards were well painted. But I wanted to grab me, and I wanted it to be something where it wasn't, there was a little bit more effort put into the story it was telling.
Mm-hmm.
And so the winner, luckily for us, and I feel really really great that he won the Tup Award, because he didn't win any other awards with that piece.
Okay, cool.
Which was awesome. And it was an awesome little duel of a big ogre kind of standing on this little hill with a bunch of like skulls around the bottom, like all his victims. And this little, I can't remember if it was, it looked almost like a teenager boy within a big horned helmet that was too big for
him. David and Goliath situation.
Yeah. And he's got a hatchet, and he's coming up the hill.
I love that.
Yeah. And it was titled Another Skull for the Pile.
Yeah.
And it was great because there was movement in the little guy. But the big thing that drew me in was the way the skin, because there's so much skin on this ogre. He's basically just wearing a loincloth. And the skin was painted so smooth and so well done that it drew me in. And then I got to see the story. So.
I love that. So, I love that you didn't pick a space marine. I'm so happy.
Yeah. And so that was great. I got pictures with him. His daughter actually won Best Young Bloods.
Oh, nice.
With her piece, too.
So do you have a picture of the piece, or are the photos posted online somewhere?
I think I do.
Okay, wonderful. So we'll show that to the goody peepees while we're talking about it.
Get that to Alex.
Wonderful.
So that is exciting. He listens to the podcast.
Nice.
I should have asked that first. I should have went around and make everyone stand by their mini and check if they listen to the podcast. But yeah, Cooley Con, if you're ever you could check it out online. If you're ever in Southwest Wisconsin, it's a fun little convention. You can play some Magic cards. You can hop in on a D&D game. You can go play some Warhammer, sign up for a Warhammer tournament. You can just hang out, you know? Check out the fucking food trucks outside, baby.
Nice. Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful.
What else you got?
I have so many things. Kill Your Friends is alive and well.
It's not been killed.
It's not been killed. So obviously, John and I filmed the very first episode of Kill Your Friends maybe 3 years ago. Or sorry, we published it. I published it maybe 3 years ago at this point, and we filmed it
a year
even
before
longer
that.
Before that. Yeah. And so that series has languished. And the reason why it's languishing is just because one big requirement is that I need to paint a full army of something to play a game. And for whatever reason, that's a difficult thing for me to seem to actually make happen. One thing that definitely encourages me to do Kill Your Friends is when a company reaches out that has a game that I already love and they're like, hey, I want to sponsor an episode of that. Like, do you want to do it? And I was like, yes. And that company was Kumani or Not. So Kumani or Not is sponsoring a Kill Your Friends episode that where me and Curtis are playing A Song of Ice and Fire, which, if I'm being frank, this is like the reason why the series exists. It's to play a game with your friends that you have a lot of experience in, and you have a lot of experience playing this friend in, because there's a lot of like built up emotion and knowledge there. I think that's going to make for the most interesting and entertaining game. And also just the most, it's what I wanted the thing to be. It's how I envisioned it.
He a lot of shit talking.
Lot of shit talking. He knows how my army works very deeply. I know his army works very deeply. We played like at least 30 games of that matchup together. And so I hope Curtis can get his army painted by October. That's the goal. So we have plans in place. I have my own plans in place. I'm painting at home to get my stuff done. I'm further along than he is. But I'm really trying to make sure that he gets his shit done. Cause if he doesn't get his shit done, and I told him this, I was like, if you don't finish your army, I'm going to have to like find someone else to play. And I know Evan has a fully painted army, and I'm planning on asking him to be kind of like my runner up here. I don't want to insult him, but I do want to have fully painted armies for the series. Cause obviously that's important.
Of course. Yeah. 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 Evan, you're on deck.
You're on deck.
You need to breathe heavily over Curtis's shoulder.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm so excited for that. It's going to be fantastic. And I know people have been asking about, like, are you ever going to do another one? And yes, I would love to do another one. And definitely is going to happen sometime in October. And it's going to come out later after October.
That's such an editing nightmare. as now, I didn't know at the time from when we recorded the Guild Ball Kill Your Friends how much, because I hadn't really edited YouTube videos at that point, how much work that was. And I still don't fully grasp because I've not done something that's that complex, but
you can grok it. You can figure it out.
I can grasp how much work that is. So
yeah, I've scheduled 15 days for myself, half a month, to fully edit that video, which seems like that should be enough. I think last time I spent probably 2 or 3 weeks editing it, but I think I can go faster now. So 15 days should be good. And that's the deadline anyways. That's when Kumani or Not expects it. I think in the middle of October is when they wanted to come out.
Perfect. Dude, so, that's totally doable.
Yeah, we'll see.
Totally doable. Totally doable. Yeah, so actually this is a really fun thing for Curtis, and I hope he keeps a positive mindset in it. Sometimes having a deadline, sometimes having something that you're, you know, it can cause you anxiety, but it's also an exciting thing to look forward to.
It is.
And that can be the push, even in those evenings. And you're like, I don't really want to keep painting. Sometimes you sit down, even though you don't want to do it. And then within 15 minutes, you get those good vibes from feeling accomplishing something. And so hopefully he looks back at this as being a positive thing, especially in an army he's played so much.
I know, and it's going to feel so good to have that fully painted army too. Like, I don't know if this is true for everyone. I don't know if it's true for you, but like, I never look back in time and be like, man, I really regret spending 40 hours editing that video. I look back at that video, I'm like, man, I'm so happy I made this, and I'm so proud of the outcome. Same thing for anything that's really challenging. You never look back on that challenging time, as long as you accomplish the thing, and regret spending the time if you're proud of the end result. So it's just like, it's kind of good to kind of give yourself a little push.
Yeah. And you're never going to be 100% proud of the end result.
Yeah.
And once you realize that, then that's often the little spark that you get for the next one.
That's the key right there.
That's right. If you felt like you climbed to the top of the mountain, then you're just like, well, there's nothing else for me to do, and you just move on to something else. And
that's no fun.
I want to keep painting minis.
Yeah.
And making dumb videos. Oh, no, I lost my spot. Next thing I have, Nova. As of the recording of this, I am leaving tomorrow morning at the ass crack of dawn to get up to get to the airport.
How early? How early?
I'm getting up, I think, at 4:45.
Dude, I had the exact same like flight time. I had a flight at like 6 a.m. and I got up at like 4 to leave this weekend too. So I could empathize.
Yeah. So this will be my first Nova. I'm pretty
nice.
Pumped.
Nice.
Super hyper stressed about bringing my little display box with my competition minis on the plane with me for a number of reasons.
Yeah, I mean, they're probably obvious. Don't put it in the fucking security scanner, whatever you do. Oh,
God. God.
I mean, you have to.
I have to, but luckily I think it's shorter
than
yours.
Is it that one?
It's that one.
Okay, you're totally good, though. You're totally good.
So that I have to sit with that on my lap and then hope to God that the person sitting next to me doesn't fucking ask me about it.
Oh, because, bro, I have the greatest story regarding that. The greatest story.
All right. Well, you're going to be forced to tell it now.
It's part of the premium already. We're good.
Oh, perfect. Perfect. I love talking with people about things that I love and that they also love.
Yeah.
I greatly despise talking to people about a thing that I love that they couldn't give two shits about that I feel like we're going through the motions on.
Yeah.
And I am just like, why are we wasting our lives here? Why don't you ask me, or why don't I ask you, or why don't we discuss something that's interesting to you? And I don't want to tell you about my little toy soldiers, lady. I just don't.
Yep.
But yeah. So that's another part of it. Also, the other big thing is that will then be considered my personal item. So when you go on a plane, you get one personal item. Usually I have a backpack. And the big stress for me is then I keep in my personal item all my medicine and all of my sugar. So it's kind of like a, you know, worst case scenario, castaway situation. I'm probably dead anyway, but anyone catches that Tom Hanks reference. But I always have what I need to survive right with me, right? Even if it's in the overhead, which it will be in the overhead, that still feels like a lifetime away, and it just makes me so nervous. But anyway,
that's fair. Also, I appreciate how mentioning a movie's title is a reference to the actor.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, normally you reference the movie Castaway by saying, like, Wilson or something like that. That's quite reasonable. Could you, like, put it, like in a sweater pocket or like something like that?
I mean, I can't do that with all my medicine because it ends up being like a quart size Ziploc bag and all that shit. Okay. But that's not as big a deal. More of a short term need thing,
like candy or something like that.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you about my candy haul.
You little Skittle bag, dude.
I got gummy Skittles.
Nice,
right? Because I don't even want to try those. Sometimes you gotta bring something new along.
Okay. Freshen it up.
Yep. Something. I also brought the tropical Mike and Ike's. Are you a Mike and Ike fan?
I'm not super into it, but it's basically fruity hot tamales, which on paper I should be into.
Yeah, they make a tropical flavor one where there's like 8 different flavors inside the Mike and Ike's one, and everyone's a banger. And so every time you stick your hand in there, it's like a grab bag of something's gonna be good.
That's a big promise, John.
Yeah. Okay. So
there's not a single flavor that's kind of like, eh.
But there's probably like a tangerine bullshit in there. Now that I think about it. But anyway, so that's I don't get them often. I went to get some snacks at the Fleet Farm. You know, my daughter, we need to go get up some dog treats and stuff. So I checked there, and they get a nice variety of things. I got a shareable bag of peanut M&Ms in honor of you.
Okay.
You're not there to bring them.
Appreciate it.
And I got a cookie dough Milky Way.
Dang, dude, you are stocked.
Dude, I don't fuck around. If I need sugar, I need sugar. And then the last thing that I'm bringing that is unhealthy, we're going to taste test in a minute.
Okay.
I didn't tell you this, but we're going to do an ad hoc taste test, tup test live, and rate a snack food. And then we're kind of going through these ideas of different little short segments for the podcast. We're finding things that we may cut from the podcast. Don't worry, it's nothing that you love. And and find these fun little jump inside segments and see if you guys like them. So that's Nova. I'm super pumped. Hang out with Vincey V. Hang out with
Sam Lenz, is he going to be there?
Sammy Lenz is going to be there. They're right. sharing a room, I think.
Ooh, you're going to crash their room?
Dude, I'm going to be Slash from Guns N' Roses in their room.
Wait, what does that mean?
I'm going to trash the shit out of them.
Okay.
Yeah. It's going to be Uncle Adam. There's going to be fucking Willie Hanna. You know, there's going to be everybody and anybody, you know. So Eric Swinson.
Yeah, okay. I'm starting to get a little jealous now.
Dude.
I mean, I was jealous as soon as
you can sneak into my checked bag.
Okay.
Because I'm not checking a bag, so then you could just be the checked bag.
Okay, I'll just fold my body up.
Yeah.
Put a little handle on my back. Where we go.
Yeah, what do you got next?
So many things. I went to Connecticut this weekend to visit my family, and whenever I travel, I bring a book to read with. And the book I brought with this time is called A Theory of Fun by Rafe Koster, who has done a bunch of talks at GDC, and they were interesting. And I figured out he wrote a book that is used in a lot of video game design courses. It's just about fun and how fun is important to games and how games are important to society. And so I gave it a read. And the book, you know, it starts at the very beginning, like what fun is, where fun comes from, how fun manifests itself in board games, what fun isn't. Like the ethics of like board games and advertising and like all this stuff. And so it was really cool to read through, and I took a bunch of notes, and I recommend it if you're like interested in game design and stuff like that. And I did a little bit more design on my dueling game as well. I can't really I haven't been making videos about it at the moment, but I've been actively working on it insofar as I've been reading books and taking notes on those things that are interesting to me, and also like making very small gameplay choices to like kind of keep moving this very giant boulder along.
Yeah,
because I think it's gonna be very easy for me, because I already have like six other fucking books in my Amazon wish list, and it's like it's gonna be very easy for me, and I can already feel it happening where it's like it feels fun to work on a game, and so I'm like doing all this tangential shit other than just making the fucking game. And so I see people like Malev, and it inspires me so much, who just like he just made a game and he just did it. And like he's just making another one that he's gonna apparently release in October. I can't remember what the date was, but like he's just doing the thing, you know. And so it's like I just need to fucking do the thing. And so I'm trying to make sure that while I'm also doing this research, that I'm also making rules, writing things down for the actual thing I want to make.
Well, what you're doing is you're to make you feel better about this.
Thank you.
Just my opinion, man. Is that that's also
sharing your opinion on our podcast?
Yeah.
What?
That's also a reference a couple people will get. Is that you're laying a foundation, right? So what you're doing is you're calling tangential work.
Wait, was that an Aliens reference? Game over, man.
No, that's
my
opinion, man. I did kind of say it like Bill Paxton.
Okay. I wasn't sure what it was.
It's Big Lebowski.
Okay.
That's like your opinion, man.
Okay. It's
what the dude says.
Right.
So anyway, you're laying this groundwork, and so often I found in corporate America, in the big projects, you know, 6, 12, 18, 24-month projects, that the sooner you just like jump into the doing, you jump into some version of the final product. The more you regret that, or the more you've made more work for yourself later on in the project, instead of laying that foundation, really understanding where your North Stars are, where your guiding points are, really having things to fall back to, really looking back at those bullet points of what is fun, how am I aligning with these things?
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have those, it's so easy to get so far off course, and you realize it when you look back at how far away that road is that you wanted to stay on, and now you've got to work your way all the way back to it. So
it's actually really interesting that you mentioned that, because like I thought of an idea for a cool way to represent 1v1 sword-based combat, and I'm having such a hard time getting away from that idea to try other ideas out, because it popped into my head. It's like I can't get rid of it, and it isn't great for like ranged base and magical combat. So it's not even good for the game I want to make. But I'm having such a hard time just moving away from that idea creatively. And so you're totally right that when you start having ideas, it becomes the thing that defines the future. And it's like difficult to remove yourself from it. And it also just feels so good to like learn all like these they're not constraints, but they're like rules maybe, or like ideas that help guide this process. Cause it's like, I have no idea what I don't know. And so it's so nice to just figure out like these building blocks of like, of game design. Cause it makes thinking about it way easier.
Hey, that just brings me back to a wonderful quote that we heard from the wise Vinci V, and that is to not be afraid to kill your babies. Right. And in this situation, your baby is that cinematic. You can see it when you close your eyes.
Wait, what's the quote?
Don't be afraid to kill your babies.
Oh, yeah. Kill your darlings. Yeah.
I prefer babies.
It's safe. Yeah.
I prefer to kill babies myself.
That's brutal.
So don't throw it all out. Don't say that I have to throw that whole idea out, but don't be so in love with it that it affects negatively other decisions.
Yes. You know? Yeah. I think I've come up with a different idea that is going to help me like use dueling people who are actual wizards and ranged people and sword people now, but it took me a long time to figure that out. But one thing that was interesting in the book that I want to mention briefly is that he has a lot of metaphors to music and to other art forms, and he asks the question like, why is board game design and playing board games like not seen as an art form? Which is like, you know, it's a hard argument to make. And throughout the book, he makes the argument that it is an art form. And he said that what all those other mediums went through is they went through this process of like defining the terms that like make up the pursuit. Mm. So using like words that describe specific art movements, specific techniques and things like that. Like once started defining it in like a, what's the word I want to use here? Not studious, but like academic sense, then it started becoming actual art forms. And so board game design is kind of in that space right now. We're starting to get like terms for game mechanics that define multiple games and like in how they're used. And I applied that to mini painting. I was like, why is mini painting not considered an art form? Are we going through the same process of like defining a vocabulary of things that apply only to mini painting and stuff like that? Which is it was an interesting thought about when something becomes an art form and is taken more seriously. Comic books, video games, all this stuff.
Yeah. We have some recent examples of those that have kind of maybe gone through that. And those are two great examples, comic books and video games.
Mm-hmm.
Which
yeah.
I think are closer to that.
Right.
And even though board games have been around for far longer than both of those
I know,
things,
for a very long time.
But it's never been looked at in that light.
Right.
And so, yeah, mini painting falls right in that as well. Maybe not in our generation, but in the next or the one after that, it will be, you know, widely considered such. So,
yeah, maybe.
Who knows?
All right. You have another pre-ramble story? I have one more.
I just got one other quick one that it's titled Minis in the Strangest Places. So I don't know how it happens, but miniatures show up. I don't know how they get there, but they get in random spots in my house. And so now I know I'm like pure nerd because last night in my bathroom, I have one cupboard. So in your cupboard under your sink in your bathroom, I have one cupboard that is just filled with all my medical stuff. So all my medicines, all the supplies, everything that I have to keep myself alive. And it's not a small cupboard, and it's filled with crap. And last night I'm packing everything, getting ready for Nova to pack all my medicine and stuff. And in there is a single clear plastic baggie with a lead miniature in it.
A lead miniature?
Yeah. I don't know. It's like a white metal miniature.
Okay.
There's nothing else in that cabinet that is anything other than my medicine. There's not a pencil. There's not a scissors. There's not tape. There's not a piece of string. There's not a button. None of those things are in that cupboard. Nothing but my medicine stuff, except for one miniature.
John's version of pocket lint is pewter models.
Yeah. I don't recognize it. I don't know where it came from. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
But it's like almost like subconsciously, I'm reminding myself of the cool miniatures I have.
Yeah.
By like sleepwalking, like in Step Brothers, where I get up and I go downstairs and I put a couch cushion in the freezer.
Yes.
Instead, I just walk downstairs. And I'm like,
you're just like planting minis all around your house,
like fucking Easter eggs.
Yeah. Okay. I love that idea.
And if I actually did that, that would be amazing.
So, you found any other ones?
I mean, I have found them in many places. They're in my daughter's room. They're, you know, they're like sitting on the kitchen table and stuff. And my wife is a saint in that she doesn't mess with any of my miniature stuff, not because I would get mad or whatever, but she's like, well, you have a plan for that, or you have it there for a reason, or you're using it for something, or I don't want to break it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so her usual great job of like picking up after me does not apply to miniatures. That's why they're probably there and nothing else is.
Okay.
So
that's fair. That's fair.
I did find one a couple weeks ago when Lou and I were looking for a movie to watch. We chose Mrs. Doubtfire, by the way. And there was one in the fucking cabinet underneath it where the TV stand.
Which one was it?
It was a chibi. I don't know.
Is Lou grabbing these things and putting them places?
I don't know. She has all her own miniatures and hers stay where she puts them. So I don't know.
Man, models that are unpainted, they get angry and they move around. Okay. Yeah. I mean, he'll skit about it. It's real.
Yeah, it's a real thing. I assume they were like riding my cat like a horse at night.
Yes. All right, I went to the East Coast this weekend for a funeral, unfortunately. And while I was there, I was at a church, and I was this has never happened before ever in my life, and it was super interesting. I sometimes get recognized when I go places, mostly game stores, mostly conventions. Yep. People recognize you for your YouTube channel. The motherfucking pastor of this church was like, "What do you do for a living?" And I was like, I'm a YouTuber. And he's like, are you Maniac? And I was like, oh my God. He's like in his pastoral Lutheran attire.
Ah, he's got the
his robes and shit. And he was like talking to me about D&D and like the videos of mine that he appreciates and that he's learned from. And I was just like, this is so surreal.
This is such a prime moment for in the midst of everyone, like, you know, people kind of huddle in their morning and they're having their little conversations, but there's a lot of people in there and the pastor comes up to you and you just like turn to the whole crowd and you yell like, blasphemer! Blasphemer! Yeah.
You must be sad.
He worships Satan in his Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, oh, yeah, yeah. Just pull out the full like 80s, 90s, like, yeah, D&D smear campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, I've never had a pastor recognize me for my YouTube channel, but that was a first.
That's fun. Does he paint minis then?
He does. Yeah, he paints minis for D&D. That was awesome. And if you're watching or listening to this podcast, it was great to meet you.
Yeah, that's awesome. I had the weirdest places I have been where people recognize me. One was in the greeting cards aisle of Target. The most recent one was at the county fair.
Yes, yes.
At the 4-H building.
I got recognized at the state fair like once, like 3 years ago. Yeah, that was bizarre. Yeah.
Those are cool because they catch me off guard. Usually, like, you're in the zone. If you're at a convention or at a game store or whatever, like, it's not that hard of a transition because you're kind of, you're ready for it and you're ready to talk.
It's possible, yeah.
But, you know, if I'm looking for a birthday card for my mom, I am not ready for that.
Yeah.
And I'm not mad. In fact, I'm more excited because it's like a surprise.
Yeah, it's
like,
easy to remember those too because they just come at unexpected times.
Yeah. So, and I will say this, almost every single one that I have been come up to not in a nerdy environment is D&D players, not Warhammer players.
Yeah. I do think that D&D players are more widespread than war gamers are. I think that D&D is just more accessible than miniature wargaming is. Like, vastly more accessible.
Yeah. Also, I kind of assume that wargamers just never leave their house.
Can confirm. I never want to leave my basement. All right. Very last thing. You mentioned a person talking to you on their airplane. And I've only ever heard of a fictional character that talks to a person on an airplane. I've never experienced it in real life.
Oh,
and boy, howdy, did I experience it in real life. And it wasn't just like a 10-minute
chat.
It was the whole fucking flight.
Was it old lady?
No, dude.
Oh no. Usually it's old ladies.
It wasn't an old lady. It was a young woman. Her name by her own admission was Hannah Banana, and she smelled a little bit of alcohol. So she was a little turnt, and then while on the plane, she drank two more Tito's vodkas.
Fuck yeah. So I like this Hannah already.
She had a little cranberry, a little seltzer. She was making her own mixers, and she was having a great time.
The fucking shaker on the plane.
Yeah, basically. The universal sign for don't talk to me.
Well, headphones on.
There's two. Headphones on, taking book out. I feel like those are like, leave me alone.
Yeah, dude, book out.
So I took my book out, A Theory of Fun, and instantly Hannah Banana was like, what's that? And I was like, it's a book called The Theory of Fun. I'm reading it because I'm looking into making a game. And she was like, I'm fun. You're fun. Let's see if we're in here. And she took the fucking book from me and started to read it. And I swear to God, she read more of that book than I did on that 2.5 hour flight.
It sounds to me like Hannah Banana was hitting on you, is what I think.
Okay. By the end, she asked for my number. And I gave it to her, but it wasn't because she knew I had a wife. We talked about Amber. But what she had said she does in Minnesota as a volunteer opportunity, which is how I'm going to tie this back to the art-related podcast, is that she runs art galleries as a volunteer. And she said that there was a possibility that I could do a gallery in Minnesota with miniatures.
Oh, sweetness.
I mean, I could even involve you, too. We could do a little joint thing, have a bunch of our models there.
Let's do it.
For an evening or something like that.
Get turnt with Hannah.
But that'd be, I mean, like, I've known Roman Lapat to do that, but I haven't known anyone else to do that. I think that'd be a fun thing to do.
I think Petrio might have done that.
I think you're right, actually.
He would. He's the kind of guy that would.
Absolutely, yeah. I didn't give her my number, but she has mine. I have no idea if she's ever going to text me. There's so much more to this story that I could definitely get into. but I eventually got my book back after 20 minutes. Like, I had to ask for it back, but I didn't read that thing at all.
Excuse me, Hannah, can I have my book back?
Basically, that was me, yeah. But that it was insane. I've never met someone who would talk to me the entire fucking flight and then also fucking take my book. It was absolutely insane.
Okay, I have questions. Okay. So when she took the book and she started reading it, did then you follow the rules of the road and then not talk to her? Or did she keep talking while reading?
I just sat there like a dumbass without a book.
It didn't have anything to do.
I had nothing to do. The headphones I had didn't even plug into my phone because my phone only takes USB-C and there was no movies on this flight because it was United.
No.
So I was just like literally sitting there doing nothing. The other dumb thing is that she was like, she heard that I was taking the train from New York City to Connecticut. And she's like, oh, that's terrible. Don't do that. I will pay for your Uber from fucking New Jersey to Connecticut. And she was on her phone in the Uber app trying to type in Ridgefield, Connecticut. And like she was having problems because we're in the middle of the fucking air and she has no internet.
she didn't know that?
She couldn't figure it out. And so in the search for Uber, she typed in connect to internet or something like that. And I was like, that is not how it works. And that's why I was like, okay, yeah, she's totally drunk. It was insane.
Wow.
It was fun and it was insane. Hannah, if you listen to this, you said you were annoying. You weren't annoying at all. It was highly entertaining. And if you want to run a fucking gallery, let's do it. I'm down.
Yeah. We will have the most ripped gallery.
The most ripped. We'll have a fucking Diet Dew there, dude.
Yeah, dude. Everyone's going to get Diet Dew and Cheetos and they can pick up all the models.
Oh, God.
Oh, man. Dude,
that's all me for the preamble. That's a long preamble.
That is such a great story. And I've got so many more questions I'm going to ask you after we're done recording. About Hannah Banana. and man, so those things too, like sometimes like the first 10 minutes of that is so awkward and then you're like, oh man, the flight went by so much quicker.
Yeah, I totally did.
You know,
I
and totally that, that's fun.
I didn't care. It was not a big deal. It was fine to chat with someone for a while.
How jealous did Amber get?
She was fine. Like, I told her, I was like, if she ever texts me, I'll tell you immediately. Like, we had a extended part of our conversation about you and like how you helped me with my business and stuff like that. And so, yeah, she got a little jealous, which I think is totally normal.
Yeah. But she should, because that means she loves you.
Yeah.
And so then you can just be like, listen, Amber, I just ooze sex.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Fucking look at my noodle arms, bro.
I can't help it.
Have you seen my short shorts, dude?
Yeah, like, I gotta wear my kicking shoes sometimes to kick them away.
Dude, I was wearing, like, tie-dye short shorts, too, so I was definitely oozing sex.
Oh, man. All right, so what I think we're gonna do is we're gonna push off the treat taste test until after the main topic discussion, or do you want to do it after what? Let's do it after what we painted.
Sure.
Okay, what we painted. What did you paint?
So, because I'm in a Shatterpoint, I started painting my Inquisitors. So I painted the Grand Inquisitor, for Shatterpoint, and I did a couple fun things that was new to me on him. I did some custom decals that I'm going to talk about in the extended portion of the episode that I printed out myself and applied to him of the Empire logo. That was a lot of fun. Inquisitors are normally painted as all black, but I've been painting a lot of all black. You saw that Yasfeti Walker last time, and even before that, I was painting black. So I wanted to change it up. And Empire, often they use white as a big color too. So I kind of changed up the scheme a little bit. I haven't painted the base yet, though.
It totally makes the piece that cool white.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it still feels like evil and like clinical, right?
100%. And almost. It almost makes it more so because it's not so, you know, over the top, ham handed, just black on black on black.
Yeah. And like, that's literally what it is. It's like the entire dude is black. I didn't know. So I don't. Okay. I'm kind of a faux Star Wars fan in that I only watch the movies. I've never seen like the TV shows or read books or comics. I didn't even know this was like a canon thing in Star Wars, but there are Inquisitors in the Star Wars universe that their job is to hunt Jedi. Mm-hmm. That is so fucking cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so as soon as I figured out about that, I was like, I need this box. I bought it, and this is the big bad in that box. Now, one thing I didn't realize is that he has these things on his forehead, right? And they're kind of a raised detail, but after blending that kind of like purplish lilac skin, I kind of lost the detail a little bit.
Right.
And so I did the thing where you kind of like rub the side of your brush over the detail to kind of like rediscover it, kind of like you're an archaeologist, you know, brushing off dust.
Yeah.
And when I did that, I was like, these are supposed to be symmetrical, and they totally are not symmetrical, but I don't know where else to paint where it wouldn't. Where it would look like I was not painting on the detail.
Right.
And so I'm like, I could do three things. I could strip the model, just the face, just the forehead, like a little bit, and repaint it. I could cut the detail off with an X-Acto knife and repaint it. Or three, I could just not give a fuck.
Yeah.
And I chose the not give a fuck route. Did you notice before I said anything?
No.
Oh, wow. Okay. Amazing.
I think it's one of those things when you have it right up to your face and you've been working on it for a while, like you see a lot of things that you don't otherwise immediately notice.
Okay, that's good. Especially if you didn't notice it before I mentioned it, then I really don't care.
I probably would have just sanded them off entirely and just painted a smooth head.
Honestly, if I had noticed it would be a problem, I would have absolutely have done that before priming the model.
Yeah,
for sure. But, or even after that.
Yeah, that's very cool. You how fun and rewarding is it to work with an off-white into glazed down shadows? Like
I didn't do it that way, but that does work well.
You didn't do that here?
I mean, I did a combination of stuff that was certainly part of the
layering
process.
Up and then glaze back.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, because it gets a little chalky and then you glaze it back and you boost it up. So I did a little bit of everything, but white definitely takes a glaze like a fucking champ. That's definitely a great strategy for getting nice smooth white blends.
Yeah, and it's so good because you're working with a color, and it doesn't have to be exactly white, but any kind of cream, off-white of any variety, and then glazing back down, it shows you such a nice, true, saturated version of whatever color that you're shading with or you're adding a tint to, that it's like, it almost makes me wonder if, like, how far you could go with just like priming a model entirely ivory and then just doing that for everything.
For everything.
Yeah. Eventually you'd come into a spot where you need to create contrast of light and dark, right? Because everything will kind of have that same realm of a, like a 2 to a 5. But I find that every single one of my models that I do, I want to do that somewhere because it works so well. And it's often the part of the model, and it shows here how that really grabs you and pulls you in. And then you see the other stuff. So
I totally agree with that. I want to show you one other Inquisitor, and I want to get your snap judgment of the model. Okay.
Quality of this model.
Quality of the model, quality of the sculpt, everything. That's the fifth brother. He is one of the other Inquisitors.
That I can't not look at that derpy ass helmet.
Thank you, dude. The helmet is so dumb. It's so dumb. I think probably the hugest contributing factor to that is that he has a chin strap. And so it feels like
I gotta keep this dumb helmet on my head.
I know, so it feels like a bicycle helmet or something.
It is. It looks like a bicycle seat that was put on his head sideways.
I okay, I And like the sad part is that like if you like go look at the comic and go look at the like the cartoon show, like that is what he looks like. And it looks
dumb
so,
character design is all that is.
It looks so fucking dumb.
It doesn't help that his armor in general is kind of generic. And that's how they're trying to make him look unique, is on the face and head. But you just chose the dumbest fucking...
I know. And like, so Obi-Wan, one of the new Star Wars shows, has all of these Inquisitors in it, which is probably why they made it into the game.
Sure.
And he looks like that with that fucking dumbass helmet. And so I hate that helmet so much. And so I had Skullforge Studios. Shout out to Skullforge Studios. If you like are into Legion, they have amazing STLs for that game. But... he sculpted me a head of the sixth brother, who is a Inquisitor who only exists in the show and also the comic book. And I'm going to use that instead, which is just way cooler.
Yeah, good idea.
But I'm torn between this, like, what if they come out with a sixth brother's model, like, in the future? And then I have two dudes with the same fucking head.
Well, they're not going to use the same head that they sculpted for you. It probably will look a different, slightly different expression or not. It won't look the exact same.
Okay. Yeah. That's where I'm stuck on.
Or just chop a fucking Mandalorian helmet on there.
There you go. Any kind of generic helmet would probably do.
Yeah.
But yeah, so.
That's a future problem. Don't worry about that.
Right. But we'll show pictures of those. I also got, if you're a Star Wars fan, Reva, the third sister or fourth sister, has a helmeted head. And she comes with her unhelmeted head in Shatterpoint. And so I also had him make up Reva's helmet, which is way fucking cooler than her unhelmeted head, and I'm gonna slap that on her. So that will be lore accurate and also more badass than the default sculpt. So Shatterpoint's fun. I'm into it. I'm customizing a warman. It's a lot of fun.
Ride that wave, baby.
I am.
That's all you can do. And then,
how about you, sir?
Okay.
I want to
see your Blood Knights here.
Oh,
because
let's do it. Yeah.
We talked about these. I saw them all printed. Oh, good. But this is the first time I've seen them with paint on them.
Yes, so I'm working on a video right now, finishing up my Age of Sigmar army. I got probably like another day's worth of painting on the unit of 10 to finish them up fully. But where they're at right now is I applied a bunch of base coats, some with an airbrush zenithly, some just like with a paintbrush. And then I gloss varnished the models, and then I applied a thin oil wash. And boy howdy, I was so fucking happy with how well it worked. It was
really good.
It was amazing how well it worked. And right now what you're looking at is, this is the first and only layer of highlights on the red armor that's going to occur. I'll do a few other highlights on the silver, on like the cloth elements, on like the spear and stuff, and maybe some metallic highlights like on the copper. I can't remember. And then they'll be done with the base.
Matte coated after that?
It's matte coated. So yeah, it's matte coated right now. It was a lot shinier than this, and I hit it with a dull coat. And it's in this kind of like satiny Games Workshop Citadel paint range world.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to keep it there, I think.
Yeah, I really like actually the metals like this. And you'll get even more contrast with any little edge highlights.
Exactly,
stuff.
Little scratchy edge highlights. I'm definitely going to add those on. Yep. And then I got to paint the skin on some guys that have faces that are showing.
Yeah. The red is perfect. I wouldn't add more to it. It's the nice, you get that one highlight, but it's such a vibrant jump up that.
Yeah. But man, I'm so happy with how well this oil wash worked this time. I've really struggled with oil washes for like a long time, and this time I really took my time to like try out different dilutions, like different tools for rubbing the paint off after it's like kind of air dried. And I was just trying things out, little changes to my process to see, am I doing this right? Is this the best it can be? Let's compare it to a known product to see if it is functioning as good as that known product.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked really well. And then with a little highlight applied, it looks even poppier.
Yeah. I find that's such a, at least to me, that's such an important thing, is to never assume you've got the best version or you are the most satisfied with the thing. Yeah. Always be tweaking, always be testing, always be curious about something.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But I think that's a much healthier way to approach it for the longevity of your painting too, just because the more you do that, the more you just kind of get rejuvenated or excited about trying something new instead of just going through the motions with just a different color.
Right. Yeah. So as a novice in oil painting, I don't know if this thing is working optimally, and so you just got to change it up and see if it gets better. That's you.
Okay. So I painted the Crimson Crocodile from Kingdom Death Monster, their brand new launched Gambler's Chest.
You and Big Deno.
Finally.
He painted the same model as you.
Yeah, it's kind of one of the big scaries in the box, so it's the one you're seeing the most painted right now. And Deno paints a lot of them. He's probably going to finish the rest of the box before I finish another model. But so, yeah, and it's just saying something because there's like, I don't know, 60, 70 models in there. But a couple things about this. First of all, the quality of their plastic sculpts on sprues, I will say, really rivals Games Workshop. It is not as good, but it is not that far off. The only downside is they get them produced in China. And so there's an issue with the engineering and their mold making that is not as nearly as good as Games Workshop. Because especially these bigger monsters, there's two problems with them. One, they're way too many pieces. That thing was probably 40 pieces.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Like the sections of the tails were, every one of those legs was two pieces. They weren't a single thing. Every section of the legs was, or the tail was like two or three pieces. All did not give a fuck about seam location. You look closely, you can probably find some.
I mean, yeah, kind of, but you did a really good job hiding the seams.
I spent a long time in using a lot of sprue goo. Yep. That whole section is two things put together, yeah. And there's no good spot to put that seam.
You almost can't see it, though.
Yeah. Also, probably the location of me putting the highlight there didn't help with hiding it.
Yeah, you're like, look at this.
Look. But for the actual painting, I wanted to do something that felt the creepiness and scariness of this model, but not just make it boring, desaturated colors. And so it was really the drive to push the attention and this almost odd, eerie, kind of fleshy, kind of something that feels alive in the bright part of its head and that curve of its neck that's almost like an arrow shape that's leading you up to its face, to make that be the focal point, but then continuing with fun, almost like chromatic colors across the piece. So that was, it was a bear, but it was...
How many hours?
I painted it in one day. It took me almost as long to build it as it did to paint it. So that's probably 6 hours, maybe five.
You know me, John. Yeah. I'll never admit that you're better at something than I am. But what I will say is you are phenomenal at efficient painting, because this would have taken me 30 hours, and I don't think it would have looked that much better than this.
Yeah, it's a lot of, when you work with a big thing like that, it's about like trying to figure out your ways to deal with the airbrush. And then it was just being selective of where you're choosing to put highlights.
I mean, it's great. Like I would definitely have assumed it was longer than you just said. And like, this is like, when people like paint for board games, they have different expectations. And this is not necessarily a board game, but it is. And like this so far and away exceeds that level of expectation for board games. But like in the mini painting world, like maybe it's like a little bit short of like a display model, but like you identified so well the things of this model that are important and what effort to put into them. And it's incredible. Like, I wish I had this skill. It's something that I am bad at, and why it takes so long to paint a single Sith Inquisitor for Shatterpoint. That model took me 15 to 20 hours to paint, which is probably longer than it took you to paint this gigantic fucking model. And like, yeah, the effect is impressive.
I think about a lot of it is when it's just like from the get-go, how you're just like chucking color with an airbrush on something. It like does something in my head that I'm not going to paint it like my clean GW thing.
When you specifically start with an airbrush, not in a base coating capacity.
Yeah. I'm not base coating in a whole color. I'm throwing down tones.
Is it random? I'm assuming it's not random.
It's not random. I have an idea of where I want the focus to be, and then I decide, is that focus going to be a cool or a warm? And this side is going to be a warm. And then I work down like the warm spectrum of the color wheel from that like yellowish orange down through oranges, down through pinks, down through reds, down to purples. And then I use purple as my next jumping off point to work back up into the cold in the opposite part of the model. So I start with that. I know where I want to place that yellow, but you got to be careful because you can't just like spray that whole thing red and then spray it yellow. I just try to keep that fairly white from the zenithal. And then I use the opposite zenithal. So topped in the right of the model, izenithal from white. In the bottom and left of the model, where you can see the teal, izenithal white from that direction. And I kind of use that as my roadmap of starting to fill in colors. In one step that made it a big difference is I used a golden so flat, like a phthalo blue. So you could use a chimera as well. When I wanted, I was like, felt like I was just about done with all the airbrushing step. And I'm like, I want to boost up some of the darker areas and still keep them saturated. And you see some of that really fun, like that phthalo blue mixing with the purple and this really like punchy indigo while it's still dark.
What is that punchy indigo? I think you use it on your space dwarf.
Yeah, it's also a golden color. It's a golden something deep purple or something.
Okay, because it's a wonderful color.
Yeah, and it really interacts really well with other colors. So it adds a lot of depth when I hit that jade color kind of where those meet. And then when that blue hit where those meet, it's like the purple is like this little fun bridge color that allows you to go further cold or further warm. It's like the stopgap that makes it feeling disjointed. And so once I got all that down, and then I kind of, because it's a big model, like I kind of like, well, you work on it like you're working on a giant oil painting. You're working in large strokes. You're working in trying to look at it further away and work at the grander piece than the smaller details. I wanted to look at smaller details as little as possible in the paint job until I got down to like painting the eyes, painting the little lines on the fingers and stuff.
The eyes like, they don't make it, but man, they contribute to the overall thing. So.
Yeah, dude.
So much.
The couple things I took away from the eyes. One, the whites of the eyes is red-gray. This is my signature color from my Broco. I love that so much because it's a gray, but it's got a hint of warmth to it. So it makes the eye feel alive. Mm-hmm. And it's not too bright. It's not too dark. And it's just like, it made it so easy. The second thing, where I had initially airbrushed over their eyes, there's some pinks, some reds, and some purples. And I did not paint over any of that. It had this fun little gradation because those fucking pupils and irises are huge on these models for a miniature. And it had this fun little gradation. So I did not want to touch it. All I wanted to do was go through with the red from Chimera, which is that bright red, and just use that to edge highlight and to create a couple of little lines as the brightest light. I'm like, I already have a gradation on all these eyes. Why repaint them? Why paint them over when I already have a thing? Also, the color that those eyes have in that gradation makes it feel like cohesive with the colors on the rest of the model. But when you punch up the highlight that much more, it sticks out so they don't blend in.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Where can you get your signature set? Some people can find that red gray.
Oh, you can go to Pro Acryl's Monument Hobbies website. You can order it directly from there. Also, check if your local game stores carry Monument Hobbies supplies and paints, and they should carry it there.
Nice. We'll have it linked below it too.
That's what I painted.
Nice.
And in the after party of things new we've tried. So if you're a patron, you get access to the after party. It's a longer version of the podcast, get another 15 to 30 minutes. And we talk about something new we've tried, miniature painting. And I'm going to talk about the base in that.
Okay, excellent. And I think now we have a little snack taste test.
Oh, snack taste.
Snack taste. Let us know down in the description. Yeah, you can, because you can edit the description. Let us know down in the comments section, good peepees, what you have been working on, and also get connected with us on the Facebook group. We have a huge Facebook group, and it's linked down in the description of all of our podcasts. Cowtails!
You ever had a cowtail before, my friend?
I don't think I have. The original caramel.
These are OG original cowtails. And these are a big thing in the Midwest. It looks like they're manufactured in Baltimore, Maryland. So maybe they're all over the place. So what we're going to do is I'm going to talk a little bit about cowtails. I'm going to describe what they are. I'm going to test them. And then we're going to rate them on a tendy scale.
Okay.
1 to 10 tendies. Okay. Can only use whole numbers. Okay. And then why you rated it.
Okay.
And so if you have a snack you think we need to taste test, mail it to us. Or just tell us down in the video description or comments. Fuck, not video description. Why did you say that? No, made me say that. Have you ever had a cowtail before?
I think I've had something like it, but I've never had, I think, the official cowtail.
The official cowtail. All right. Take a little bitey bite.
Okay. initially.
Describe what it is. What is it?
It is a cream-filled caramel roll.
Mm-hmm.
It's a semi-firm caramel, so it isn't like melting in my hand. I can hold it. It's not sticky. And the middle is kind of like a, yeah, it's a cream. It's like a royal icing-ish consistency cream. It's better than what I remember the competitors tasting like and also feeling like.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, the middle part was like grainy and bad.
Yeah.
And this is actually kind of smooth and creamy.
Yeah. It's got a nice balance with the cream and the caramel. The caramel's not a award-winning caramel.
No.
But also, it's a mass-produced candy. The award-winning caramels are usually more homemade kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the balance is really nice. I like the consistency of the caramel. It's not a hard caramel. It's not a soft caramel. It's right in the middle.
Right. And also, it's pretty subtly flavored. It's not smacking you in the face with anything.
It's not overtly sugary sweet.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to give it 7 out of 10.
Yeah. I remember having cow tails as a child because my dad is never really a candy person, but I remember he really liked cow tails. So when we like go to the gas station or something, I remember like my dad would like them. So then I had them as a kid. So then you want to like them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have them all the time, but when I was at the Fleet Farm, baby.
Yeah. They'd fucking be there.
They had a big old sack of them. So I put a handful in my bag going to Nova and I was like, this is a perfect treat test.
There it is.
It is not my go-to thing. If I have them once or twice a year, I'm glad I got them.
Yeah.
You know, I think they should make everyone's treat rotation. My number is also 7 out of 10.
What were you? I was in between 6 or 7.
No, I was between 7 and 8.
Okay.
But I think an 8, you gotta really knock my socks off, right?
Yeah.
They don't knock my socks off, but they're like Wolverine, right? They have a job and they do it well.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, I agree with that assessment. Yes.
Okay. So comments below. Have you ever had a cowtail? Do you like cowtails? They make other flavors of cowtails. This is the OG. This is the best one. I tried an Oreo one recently.
Oreo is the... So what do they change? The filling or the outside?
The cream is the same on the inside.
Okay.
Which is clutch.
That's the staple.
But it's basically just like a chocolate outside.
Okay. Okay.
But the chocolate isn't as good as the caramel is, in my opinion. They're still good.
Okay.
Still good. They make other ones too. I think they may do like a caramel apple one.
Mm-hmm.
Where the inside cream is like a sour apple.
So they change up both.
Yeah, they're not fucking around.
Yeah, dude. Cowtail, fucking fearless brand.
Yeah, they can give a shit. Let's shout out to Getz Candies.
Getz Candies?
G-O-E-T-Z. Getz Candies. Does contain wheat, milk, and soy.
My dad's candy that he liked that I also grew to like that isn't super exciting is Bitto Honey. You ever had Bitto Honey?
Bruh. I don't love Bit of Honey. My brother loves Bit of Honey. I'm okay with Bit of Honey.
Yeah.
Fun fact, every Christmas for the last like 25 years, I've gotten my brother a bag of Bit of Honey for Christmas.
It's not amazing candy. It's like kind of fun to chew on and it tastes a little bit like honey. But it's not great. All right. That was the little snack taste test. Again, let us know what you thought of that fun segment. Also, let us know about a candy that we can try out in the future in one of those little segments. Now on to the main topic, which is from a viewer. The viewer's name is Kern. And Kern asks this. Why are the mainstream miniature or skirmish games competitive instead of cooperative? Is there room for growth in the cooperative space? What kind of barriers exist for games of this type? And what could be done to mitigate those barriers? And an example of one of those barriers is using an app to manage AI turns, where the barrier would be you're alone or you're playing cooperative, you have no enemy, that enemy is controlled by AI. And some games have done this before. Virtually every single game that's D&D in a box, like Descent or the one that's...
Gloomhaven,
the one that Steamforge made, starts with the B, that you've tried out, that you painted models for.
Oh, Bardsung?
Bardsung.
Almost done with that campaign, man. We're still cranking away out.
Aeon's Trespass. They all have an AI that controls how the player works. So anyways... That's the question. Why are mainstream miniature games more often competitive than cooperative?
Hmm. My initial gut reaction to this is I think it goes into the history, the origins of the games. So
like how deep we're going here. Are we getting into anthropology, or are we?
yeah. We're gonna dust off those runes on that dude's head.
find some hieroglyphics. This fucking army list.
Oh no, man! He's using Terminators. They sucked in this edition. the history of like the little historicals, right? Little historical miniatures where they replay the Revolutionary War or whatever, and they were the little tin models and stuff. All of that was to depict, reenact, strategize for, which is kind of the origin of these, is the generals on a map laying out all their shit where their forces were going to go and stuff. And it all was about war. It was all about beating your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
It makes sense if you're playing a game that you are that you'd be beating your enemy. So I think there's a certain kind of bloodline to it,
yeah,
of that it is about competitive. I don't even say competitive. Competitive in the sense that you are battling wits and strategy against another person, much like chess.
That's interesting. So yes, it's trying to emulate war, as its name suggests. And I'm sitting here asking the question, could that be cooperative? Could you do war where you and a player were working against some kind of AI in a setting like that? Like, you know, you're playing Nazi sniper zombie elite, and you and your buds are capping off fucking fascist zombies with sniper rifles. That is war. That is cooperative, and it is fun. So, like, does a game like that exist with, you know, in the scope of war that could be cooperative? Probably.
Yeah, that's my first thought is
historical,
is the history of the games. Okay. And so it's kind of, it's intrinsic to it, and probably the player base that you have that are your most likely consumers to want to buy your game are not brand new people for most of these games. You're trying to get them to try your game when they have a history of playing these kinds of games, and they are used to a certain thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. Yeah. You're trying to capture your target audience. There's a certain innovation limit to what you can do when you're developing a new product. You can't make your thing so different that it alienates your target audience. If you do that, then you have a failing product. So, yeah.
Even if it's an amazing product.
Right. So, like, yeah, that's another thing, is that it is that we kind of, people expect that, and so we just make games for what people expect. That's a good idea. I think to further the discussion of history, I think there is a very short anthropology discussion we can have about humans and how we attribute status to combat and victory in combat, and that like elevates your position in a tribe. And so like there is some kind of just a natural human inclination to want to compete, because it does show something about I am better than this other person, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that there is like something kind of almost baked into our psyche that suggests that competing has this great outcome in advancing our status. So that is I don't want to talk too long about that because I'm not very well versed on it, but that could contribute to why most games competitive? Would you say most games are competitive? Just games in general.
Yes.
Sports, basketball, everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you have to, you kind of get to almost to like a different subset or a different genre as you're moving away to that. And I think the only reason even that this is a conversation that we are having is to even consider that the games wouldn't be competitive or wouldn't be against the person across the table is the recent rise in popularity. One, the resurgence of Dungeons and Dragons, which is pretty much a cooperative game. And two, the board game rise, where those are largely now cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a level of technology, there's a level of innovation in rules writing and finding a way to play those games, but also there's a level of technology in understanding AI of how the game will work on its own. Because you have to you're always playing against something else. So just like a game of football, if I'm playing Madden on my PlayStation, I am still playing a competitive game. I'm just playing against the computer.
Mm-hmm.
So they are still competitive games. They're saying that we are having some segment of a math equation or a bunch of, you know, if-then statements or whatever, and cards that tell me rules that replicate and a human opponent.
Yes.
And so it's interesting. In that regard, there's no such thing as a competitive and a cooperative game. They're all competitive. You just may have more than one human mind on your side of the competitive table.
That is a very interesting take. And I think I would at least initially agree with that, your statement that you made. Yeah. That is pretty cool.
Yeah. So I think, okay, when you were talking about that, I was like, yeah, like when I think about the games, I think about video games, my history in video games, the games that stick out to me the most, the games that I felt like I've had the biggest, highest highs, the games I had the most fun with, the games in the moment are most rewarding. It's the games where there's a high competitive side of it.
Of course.
Right. Right. Whether it's long term.
I don't think that's true for everyone. I think that's definitely true for you and I. But I think some people really have fond memories of single player experience.
Yeah. And that, yeah, there's a really big asterisk there.
Yeah.
I think that there's a large enough percentage of the population that it may not even be the majority of the population, but there's a large enough percentage of the population that do get that reward off of that competitive against other humans aspect, even if it's virtually through a video game, that those really resonate.
Yes. You know? Yeah. And so one thing that I learned in that book I recently finished was that humans really enjoy learning in a certain style. And in board games, I don't mean like kinesthetic learner. I don't mean that kind of bullshit. I mean that the joy of a board game is figuring out the logic puzzle in it. Humans are always trying to make things simpler for ourselves, right? Yeah. And so what a user is doing in a game is trying to figure out the optimal path to victory. And there are many optimal paths. You know, hacking a video game is an optimal path to victory.
Yeah.
So like we're always trying to make things easier for ourselves. And when it comes to competitive games where the enemy is not AI, you have this almost infinite buffet to just keep consuming of playing this game, because the randomness comes from what your opponent is going to do, which is totally unpredictable. And so the game state is always interesting and it's constantly changing. Whereas with a game where the thing is an AI, it's like, how often do you beat a single player game and then change nothing about the game and replay it, right?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that happens. That does happen. But like, if I were to do that, I'd increase the difficulty. I would like put a challenge on myself. I would make it a little bit more difficult because I'm trying to learn a new thing. I'm trying to up the ante. And so it's interesting. I think that you hit it on the head. There are no competitive and cooperative games. They're all the same. And what I would say is that I would agree with you. We're all trying to solve the logic puzzle of the game. And it just so happens that in a competitive experience, that logic puzzle is more varying and it changes more often. It's more interesting to chew on than cooperative games tend to be.
Mm-hmm. I think, and I don't know if Kern had this as a point or the reasoning behind the question, but my brain then will go to there's some kind of caveats to that. When we think of many games, whether it's playing a game of soccer or it's playing a game of Go or playing a game of Go Fish or whatever it is. And these are all competitive games.
Mm-hmm.
Boiled down to it, the rules are fairly simplistic and there's a shared understanding. And because of that, The game can play itself out without the game itself jumping into your face and becoming a hurdle for you doing it. The hurdle, the challenge, the amount of variables is on your opponent. It's on the moves that they make. It's on the understanding of the rules and how they're using them best in a situation, and you adapt or you think 2 points ahead or you react. In miniature war games, in general, it often really feels like the rules get in your way a lot, and it may come to having ideas like this of where it can be so frustrating because the rules aren't balanced. There's so many variables in which army and which unit and is every single weapon and is every single ability and is every single synergy. Are they balanced? Are they setting up an even soccer field where the goals are the same dimensions
and they're both equidistant from midfield, and they all have the same amount of boundaries, and they all have the same referee that's judging both sides, you know, equally, and everything is set up for a fair match before you get on the field, that doesn't mean that a 7-year-old couldn't is playing Pele as a fair match.
Right.
But that is then on the decision that you're getting to.
I think you just, I took a note of this, but I don't know if you read my notes. I just mentioned the thing about why competitive games might be more interesting than cooperative. And I also mentioned the mastery problem. And you just described the mastery problem. And that, like, humans want to learn the logic puzzle of games, but they also want to do easy things. And when that 5-year-old is playing against Pele to figure out how to play soccer and they get dunked on repeatedly, you know what? The easiest solution to figure out a game is just to quit.
Yeah.
Stop playing.
Yeah.
And so in competitive games, you have this mastery problem where you have these people that want to learn your game. They want to chew on the fun logic puzzles. But if the thing you hand them is outside of the realm of their, like, expected ability or their perceived ability, they'll just give up. And so I'm assuming what you're about to say is with cooperative games, you can eschew that. You can avoid that in a big way.
Because we're doing it together.
Exactly. Yes.
And it's a totally different mindset too.
Yes, it totally is.
I think when the complexity of miniature war games is part of the allure, like if every dwarf, human, skeleton, orc, whatever, the standard troops were all basically the same with just a different coat of paint, that would be boring. Yeah. That wouldn't be cool. That wouldn't be complex.
Or if there was two phases of the game, whatever, you know, that wouldn't be as fun. Yeah.
We want it to be this interesting soup that we are adding all our own ingredients and putting our own individual stamp on to make them our army. That is like such a drive to these games. But that sword is double-edged, and that edge is that all those things that we want are also the things that make the games get in our way of feeling like a fun, balanced, equal opportunity with all everything else, you know, set aside that way. And then an easy way to then say, well, that's a frustrating thing, or I feel that, or people talk about that, or I'm worried about that in starting this. What are the other options? Well, what if we get out of each other's way and we're not doing that, instead we're on the same side? Then that's a logical conclusion to draw. And maybe that's why the question's asked, or maybe it's not, but it is a question you could ask.
Yeah. And I want to allow us to keep talking about that question. Why are mainstream games more competitive than cooperative? But I also want to make sure we answer all the questions because they're all interesting. So is there room for growth in the cooperative space for miniature war games?
I think so. I think if we've seen all the success in games like Kingdom Death Monster, in games like, I mean, they made the fourth highest grossing Kickstarter of all time amongst all categories.
What about our homie VNCV, Space Station Zero?
Right.
Majestic. Majestic 7. Majestic 7? Did I get that
those
wrong?
Are miniatures. Majestic 13.
13. 7. What the fuck?
You're halfway there, living on a prayer. So yes, those are great examples. Demon Ship is solo, right? Or you
it's
can
solo.
Play cooperative though too.
Can't solo,
you?
It's solo and cooperative. Yes, you can combine spaceships.
Sorry, Ghost Boat. Wrong.
Wrong game.
I mentioned the wrong game. Sorry, it's called Ghost Boat. Yes, so there are examples in the micro game, this more skirmish style, and all that. I think if you look. A lot of these, and I've played quite a few now, and on my backlog of more to play with Dan and Alexa of our cooperative miniatures board games, much of how they play and much of how they feel is not that much different than playing a game of Age of Sigmar. The only real difference is we're playing with smaller numbers. We're playing more on a skirmish style than we are in a full army style. But the logistics and how these different companies and different games have adapted their rules and leaned into what works well with the computer-controlled AI
and giving the autonomy and choice amongst your players seems like that's not a very far bridge to cross to make happen.
No, I don't think it is either. So my answer to the question is yes, there's absolutely room to grow in the cooperative space as well. But I'm interested in hearing why or how you came to the conclusion that Age of Sigmar isn't so far removed from Kingdom Death. Because I do see them as, obviously they have miniatures. Obviously are you rolling dice in Kingdom Death? I actually can't remember if you're rolling dice. Okay.
They're all closer akin to Dungeons & Dragons than they are to Age of Sigmar.
Okay, yeah.
But
that's kind of what it felt like when we played at Adepticon.
Yeah. But they're not, I mean, the mechanically and how things work and how you, actions you have, phases you have, all those kinds of things, they're not that foreign.
Okay, yeah. Generically, right? Yeah.
Generically, they're not foreign.
Gotcha.
Okay. I mean, if you just did a basic, like, test of, like, okay, if you set up a virtual tabletop that you had a bunch of if-then statements put into it for the computer, you can play a virtual game of Age of Sigmar, or you play your vampires and the computer plays orcs, could that game be played? I think so.
I wonder if that exists. Has someone made an AI for playing like tabletop simulator against a computer opponent for wargaming? That seems very complicated to make.
And in that regard, like, it there's a lot of variables, which is the draw to a game like Warhammer.
Exactly.
And for that computer, now granted, computers are already, and within the next number of years, are going to be far smarter than us, and we'll be able to figure it out. All right. All you need to do is get an AI, a version of ChatGPT, they'll be able to do the optimal turn based on the numbers.
ChatGPT fucking powered Warhammer AI.
Yeah. Then you'll never win a game. Yeah, other than the dice rolls. But then I'm just like, well, if you're playing an AI, you're still playing a competitive game. You need to, the whole game needs to be built around the value of you working with another person.
Right. Like that needs to be the way you earn the victory through cooperation.
Yeah. Through splitting up resources and redistributing resources, and you doing a thing because it may not be the optimal thing for that unit that you ran over there, but it is based on what your buddy is then swinging around the other side to, you know, to smash him in the ravine or whatever. I don't know. So, yeah, I think the game absolutely could be done that way. I think it's a different environment. It's a different kind of a play experience. It's a different mindset. When I sit down and I want to play at a tournament for Magic, or I want to sit down and play a game of Age of Sigmar, it's a different experience. It's different kinds of fun. It's different total environment interaction than the kind of game when I every Saturday night and we play cooperative miniature board games. It's a totally different experience. Yeah. They're so different, even though mechanically they're cousins, right? But the actual how we play, how we interact, how we have fun, what excites us in each of those are on different planets.
Yeah,
to me anyway,
it is
my experience.
It's the same for me as well. And you kind of touched on it earlier, but like, the balance of a cooperative experience is like not a question anyone has. Like, no one cares about that. In fact, what they care about is it being imbalanced. You want the experience to be difficult, because if it's easy, you're going to play it once and you're never going to play it again. Like, you want something to strive for. Right. So that kind of gets thrown out the window. And yeah, my whole frame of mind completely changes when I'm playing a cooperative game, because it's just way more chill. It's just a way chiller experience.
Yeah, when you're going against another person at the table, I think that's where some of the negativity comes from miniature war games, is because it's easy to have a scapegoat, and sometimes it's very it's very true, and sometimes it's not true at all. But it's very easy to have a scapegoat of things not going your way or you not having fun for whatever reason and putting it on the game, right? If we're playing a cooperative game and we get our butts kicked, and that has happened many times with me in games, I've never once been mad at the game. It's been like, okay, huh, it does it that way. All right, well, I guess we learned that we should not do that, or we need to like take these on one at a time, or we need to blah, 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 blah. Like you strategize. You try to find a way to beat the thing.
Yep.
But when I'm playing you and, you know, I got a unit of 40 skeletons and you smash into me with the unit of 10 blood knights and the maximum possible damage they could do by the numbers is 41 and you do 40, kill all 40 skeletons, I'm fucking pissed. I'm like, that shouldn't happen. This is dumb. This game is dumb. I hate it. Is whatever. You know? You know, so it's just like the higher level of tension, the sheer amount of time it takes to play a game, the amount of time I put into building, painting, whatever. And, you know, it just, this level of stress and tension in it is a lot higher in those games. And that's also one of the reasons why the can be the most exciting and most fun moments. I will tell you that even in Age of Sigmar, a lot of times it's a very frustrating experience. I've probably had 10 amazing experiences, moments in games of Age of Sigmar for every one I have had in playing cooperative board game.
Right.
Board games can get me to a 6 or a 7 a lot. Age of Sigmar can get me at a 2 to a lot.
Yeah.
But Age of Sigmar can ding that 10 bell.
Yeah.
And those other ones, and that's just also a personal, maybe there's a personal part of it too. Without the lows, there can be no highs.
Yeah.
You know? You have to ride that roller coaster, and maybe that's part of it.
Yeah. Another thing that I learned, so I made my first episode about making a game, and I said I wanted to make a dueling game, and I got so many comments. This is related. So many comments by people who are like, you can't have one model versus one model. It's not going to be interesting. Consider having a companion, like a pet, or consider having it be an arena-based game where you have a 3-on-3, 5-on-5, like World of Warcraft Arena. Like, you can't have a 1v1 model game. And I was so confused at first. I was like, why can't I? Like, what are you talking about? And then I started to think about it more. And this has been a thought that's been kind of rattling around in my brain for a while, and I haven't like fully figured out how to say it totally. And you kind of touched on it earlier, but I think it's changing now. But for a long time, war games have existed in this massive echo chamber. Mm. And if you look at every single one of GW's games, at least the ones that I've played, Warcry, Underworlds, 40K, Age of Sigmar, Warhammer Fantasy,
Kill Team,
they all have this similar structure to gameplay. And this is the structure of for combat. You roll the hit, you roll the wound, you roll an armor save, you roll a bravery check. And that's like the flow of combat. And some of these don't have all those steps. Some of them have maybe one more, but they all have looked this way since Rogue Trader, the first version of 40K, has come out. And people have a very difficult time fathoming something outside of their expectation. And so I agree with those people. If I made a 1v1 game and you rolled the hit and you rolled the wound and then it passed back to the other player, that'd be boring as fuck. That'd be the worst thing in the world. And that is absolutely not what my game is going to look like at all. So the reason I say this is because people have this, and this is the last question. What are the barriers? How do we get rid of them? The biggest barrier is what people expect of what a miniature war game is supposed to be and how much you can change that. And so to get past this barrier, people's expectations, I would be like, okay, how do I make Age of Sigmar a cooperative game? What does that look like? That's changing the least amount of stuff that I can change so that's palatable for my target audience while still accomplishing my goal of making it a cooperative game. The goal isn't to make Age of Sigmar cooperative. The goal is to see what a cooperative war game can look like, starting with AOS as a template. Mm. And so it's like, so that's the barrier to me, expectation, because I ran right into it. It was insane. And also a little bit of commentary about how GW has had the same design language for war games forever. They've changed. Things have changed. I know that. But it stayed very, very same. And there are many games that have very different ways of doing combat. And what's interesting is actually this design language, it falls outside of GW all the time. Song of Ice and Fire, you have a hit, you have an armor save, you have a morale check. Like, all these things exist in that game as well. And many other games outside of GW's, like, kind of fold of games. And so, yeah, I'd figure out how to make a game that is going to hit a lot of the same beats that hits all the games that we love and expect, while also still being cooperative. Because if you change so much about the game, suddenly you have a board game and you're targeting a board game audience, and it's not the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's my TED Talk.
I had an interesting thought about cooperative in Warhammer specifically, because in specifically 40K. I was not aware when I first got into the hobby and understood what it was that there is a large segment of people that play that game, play Warhammer 40K specifically, probably 30K, a lot of, there's some there too, that played narrative games.
Yeah.
And to me,
it's a thing in AOS too.
Yeah. It is. I just felt like it's a stronger thing, or it's a bigger tie in 40K, because trying to play out this certain battle and trying to tell the story of whatever, and there's even full narrative campaigns. We've had a local one that they had done one,
yeah,
over like 8 sessions or whatever.
Okay, I can see how that would be a stronger thing at 40K, because it's more tied to the narrative than the fresher AOS is.
Yeah. Also, the narrative in 40K is a lot more of a hot fucking mess, and you can just say this thing happened and no one can say otherwise, because that's what the official writers do. So AOS is a little bit more streamlined. It was like, this actually happened, and then that happened, and then that happened. And those people, I'm just talking, you people, I mean, I talk to people that, local players that play that, by and large, there's as many, small segment, but my city, there's as many people, or almost as many people, that are narrative first or narrative only players than are come to the regular game night, go to tournaments, you know, play to try to improve their list, that kind of group. There's a good, you know, those are numbers are not that much different. And to me, that version of narrative Warhammer, that is cooperative play.
You're cooperating to recreate a story from the game that you both jointly love.
And it's not even, because I've watched some of them, like bits of them playing their games and stuff too. And it's not even like that they're doing a play by play, or they're explaining, or they're like being a narrator or whatever. Some people do that, and that's fucking cool, I think. But that's how I'd do it. But it's more like you set this different environment, a different expectation of when we sit at the table, where our goal is not to play the most badass, strongest units for this army and to do whatever to try to make sure I beat you.
Right.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to reenact a thing. It's like, oh, actually, this battalion, they were mostly dudes on motorcycles, right? And they had their old-timey warhound with them and whatever. And so it's like, oh, points, whatever. Like, oh, balance, whatever. Oh, you can only field 3 bikes in a battle. Now, whatever, like you're setting up the story and seeing how it plays out, and just their approach to the game that way means that they don't get those ones and tens on their hate or joy. Their joy is more of that constant 7, because they're enjoying every moment, good, bad, or the other, because that's determining what actually happened in this battle. They're almost like separating themselves from the outcome of the game. They're just like the god in the sky that's moving the soldiers and determining what the soldiers do. And that's maybe a healthier way to go about the bullshit of frustrating roles and stuff in Warhammer, because you're like, it's in the hands of the gods. I'm just seeing what happened when these men and these Xenos met, and what happened, you know, when randomness of the universe was brought into play and two fierce competitors showed who ended up winning. And maybe that's a healthier way to think about every game of Warhammer. Maybe you won't have as much fun, or maybe there's a balance there. But to me, those games feel cooperative. And maybe it's more of the approach than it is designing a whole different, entirely different rule set where it's me and you on the same side of the table.
That is, I think that's a pretty That's a pretty profound idea. And it really, immediately when you said it, I immediately thought of wargaming differently. I imagine a situation where it's like, I have a vehicle and I want to hide this vehicle behind terrain so it doesn't get shot and obliterated in the first turn. And like, maybe that happened in real war, but also like, maybe in real war, you would just like be able to weather the storm from weapons with your sci-fi vehicle. And so you can just roll up straight up in the battlefield, not being worried about exploding. Whereas in 40K, you know, that's more of an option. And so what I'm trying to say is that if I played a game with that kind of thing in mind and both players were on the same page and we were just like...
You had that Hannah Banana mentality.
Yeah, you had that theoretical run it down mid mentality. And it's like, I'm not going to try to best abuse this game's rule structure to get the greatest outcome for myself and rack my brain trying to solve this logic puzzle. I'm just going to like fight like I imagined my dudes would fight in the story that I enjoy.
Yeah.
And that most often is just fucking sending it down mid and just like having fun. And if your opponent is doing the same thing, it's like, sure, pop my Raider and blow it up on turn one. I don't care. Like there are other things that you are trading to me that I'm going to shoot and obliterate as well. It's because we're trying to just do a simple war scenario. And that changes the experience. But the moment that person makes any strategic choice that is going to give them favor in the game is the moment this brain turns on, and I'm like, okay.
You just flip the choke.
You just ruined it for me. I am now going to crush as best as I can.
It is. They make the choice that is the logical, optimal choice that gives them no detriment for having chosen it.
Yeah.
And like, it's boring. Also, it's typically boring, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, come on. Fuck yeah, man. Dude, you had all those little fucking plague dudes over there, and they could have been plaguing.
Yeah.
Why aren't you plaguing with the plaguesters,
You're just
bro?
Sitting on an objective, bro? That's so lame. Like, the plague guys, they want to plague people. Get out there.
There's a whole fucking field of daisies over there that could be plagified, and you're just sitting, you're like, we're going to sit on the stick.
Yeah. Yeah, so... It's a dangerous place for me as a gamer because I like to emulate what my opponent is doing across the table from me, and I have to win as well.
Right.
So you said that, and I thought about wargaming differently, like instantaneously. And I think you're right. I think that is a version of cooperative play, like in spirit.
Yeah. And it almost like, and I know that companies like Games Workshop, I know that certain events like, oh shoot, and some of the ones that Vince has told me about that are just so freaking cool, that
Holy Havoc,
perfect, that was the one, I want to shout them out, that there are events that run with this spirit, that run with the, this is not about, you know, curb stomping people's events, it's about what fun things can we do together. And it's a combination of creating a culture change, you know, setting up an environment where that's rewarded, and showing people and having people create good word of mouth that those experiences, those rewards, those things built into it, probably even built into the game itself or built into the tournament structure itself, are more valuable than the devil on your shoulder saying, let's find the most broken, bent combo or unit and spam it to victory.
Mm.
And I think that each of us has this, are on a sliding scale of whether on one side is that version of the player that is, it does not matter what the models look like, does not matter what the army is, does not matter how it plays. If this is the strongest, this is what I am going to do. And the flip side of that is the person is like, this is the coolest army for me. These are the coolest units in this army for me. I don't care how cool they are in the game. I don't care how good they are. It's the coolest looking. I love them. That's the army that I play. And so we're all somewhere on the spectrum of there.
Woo.
Of that light to dark of player. And so it's like how can we move the needle a little bit more towards the one side of just enjoying playing the things that you want to play in a play style, army play style that fits your personality that you enjoy playing.
It all comes down to us as humans breaking out of this desire for Minnesota niceness. You know, I've been really running into this in my normal life, just like people not telling me what they want and what they mean and assuming what I want and what I mean, and then acting based on an assumption, whereas I say what I want and what I need and people don't listen to me. So it's like this, it's like when you chalk up to play a war game, don't think about what the expectations of a war game are and what you think your opponent is going to enjoy in that war game and where they get their joy. Walk up to that war game and ask them, maybe even before you walk up to the war game, maybe on Facebook when you're trying to find someone to play a game with, be like, what kind of experience are you looking to have?
Right.
Because this is the kind of experience that I want to have. And if you don't want to have that, that's totally fine. I'm not a bad person. You're not a bad person. I'm not destroying the hobby. Like, this is just the way I enjoy it. And there are other people that want to enjoy it that same way. And it's about just connecting with them and plainly stating what it is you need out of the experience and not feeling bad about it. I think just communication, just tell people what you want and find people that also want the same thing.
So that is wise advice. It can be.
Do you feel that people like not being honest about what they want?
They feel like they're being selfish, or they're putting themselves out on you.
Yeah.
In reality, and this is true. The older that you kind of, I feel anyway, the older I get, at least, the more I'm just like, no, this is all going to go so much better, no matter what it is, if we're just upfront and then we become cooperative, because I know what you're asking for, you know what I'm asking for, so we can work together to get there, as opposed to this fucking shell game of I don't know, you don't know, but we're both just trying to be polite, so we think that's the way to go about things.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah, that's it. I think we solved this, I'm pretty sure.
I think we did.
I guess the moral of the story, TLDR, if you just skip through the whole main topic, it is play more narrative 40K. Oh, man. I don't know if I can do that. I would, but I would make up shit so real, so bizarre and so ridiculous. And then until the person I'm playing gets mad that my shit's ridiculous, and then the whole punchline is, it's equally as ridiculous as everything else. That's my punchline.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So just dig into the weird. R.I.P. Pee Wee Herman.
All right, that was great. That was a great discussion. I'm hot off the presses of talking about games, and so I'm like fiending for chats about games. I don't know if you do this, but like, and maybe I've mentioned this before.
No, I don't do it.
Okay, great. while I'm in the car, like, or when I'm alone, not ever, but every once in a while, I will have a conversation with myself about a topic that I don't understand, trying to explain it to a imaginary audience or person, because I have discovered, and you know this too, when you can explain something, you fully understand it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I like practice scripts, or I practice explaining intentionally very complicated things. I try to explain how the Dota Pro Circuit works, and to no one who's listening, because it's very complicated.
Yeah.
And I also try to do things about games. And so I'll have tons of conversations about games in my head to no one that's listening. And maybe in the future they become videos or whatever. But I don't know for now. Do you do that? Do you talk yourself?
Okay. I do. There's a big process in that also, from a more formal capacity. Every time I'm writing a script for a video too, like I have to. You want it to seem like you didn't spend any time in writing that.
Right, yeah.
You want it to seem like you're just like, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, and it's supernatural. Yep.
And it came out in a way that no matter, you don't want to talk down to anyone. You want it to make it so that as many people as possible can grasp it in as few words as possible.
I know, yeah. And that's a struggle, because in as few words as possible, like, then you start using bigger words, you start saying things more eloquently. It's like, it's important to repeat your thesis statement as well. So it's like, how often do you repeat it? It's like, I really struggle with that, and I'm sure I fail many times.
I think I do too. The thing that I tell myself is that as long as I am willing to keep putting in the effort to try to do it, I'll have lesser failures, or I won't fail as much,
or my failure won't be as big as it could have been if I've been trying every time to do that. And hopefully, you know, more people, you'll get more light bulb moments for people. That's the goal. And you can't win them. You can't win them all. But yeah, I think that's a really good exercise. Cause I mean, it's funny because my brother, we had a birthday party for my nephews last weekend, and he's got two boys that are 10 and 7, and then his daughter is just turned 15. And we're sitting around the dinner table around lunch, and his daughter was there, and my mom and a couple other people were like asking her about like what classes she's taken in high school. She's in ninth grade, so she's in high school for the first time, and what kinds of things she thinks she wants to do, or the whole what do you want to do when you grow up kind of conversation came about. My brother's sitting there too, and he made the same kind of a comment that I can distinctly remember being seared into my brain as a child that my dad made to me was, as long as you do something that will be stable, that it, you know that it's a strong job, and that it's not something that your degree is going to mean you're only going to be flipping burgers. Like, flipping burgers is just like a euphemism that my brother, my dad used for whatever. It's just like a negative downplay on people's careers. Okay. And so I was just like, oh, and it just made me so upset.
Did you say something?
Yeah. I was like, I told her,
Dad, look at me.
Yeah. So, and it was my brother. My dad was even sitting there, but she loves art. She's a really good artist and stuff. And so I'm like, or Leah, do what makes you happy, do what makes you excited, and do what doesn't seem like work, and it'll all work itself out. Because it's if you're excited about talking in a way that helps people learn and sharing your excitement for your hobby through a video, it's such a weird niche thing that why does this even exist? 10 years ago, this wouldn't have existed.
No.
But if you have that passion, and that's what drives us for every video, for us getting up and recording this, and it's getting up back to the painting desk and excited about the next project, that passion will take you further than anything else any other person tells you you're supposed to do. And I just hope that all the goody peepees find their passion, whether it's in their hobby, whether it's in their family life, whether it's in their work, find something that drives you, and make sure you keep listening to the podcast while you do it.
That was a wonderful topic. Thank you to Kern for asking that question. We really appreciate that. As a patron of the podcast, you can not only submit models for us to give feedback to, you not only get access to an extended episode, but you also get to ask questions that eventually or may or may not become a topic on the podcast. And we'll credit you during the episode. So if you want to become a patron for that reason as well, you can find it linked down into the description. And now we're on to the news segment.
Let's talk about the great Ocean's 11 of Gen Con.
Okay.
2023.
Yes, the heist.
Yeah, yes. The heist. The dudes walked in.
You know about this.
I know about this. Yeah. So two dudes walked in. I think it was in like the loading dock area where all like the vendors and all that shit, they've got to go through to get all their shit in to set up their booths and or whatever. They just kind of like walked in with purpose. They knew what these fuckers knew what they were doing. They came in, took a pallet jack, took an entire pallet filled with boxes of magic product. It's a packs and whatever. And they just left. They just went right out the back door. Do. No one stopped them. Whatever. Because I'm sure there's people coming and going and doing shit all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They just left with it, loaded it in their van, and got out of there. And they projected at about $300,000 worth of magic cards.
Dang, dude.
They got like good pictures of the faces, and they like can find, like, I guess they from people recognize, and they knew who these two dudes were.
Oh no. So they got found?
I don't know if they've caught them yet or not, but I feel like their Bonnie and Clyde story is gonna be short lived.
Dang.
And so yeah, that was the Great Magic Heist at Gen Con, which because of the dollar amount, Writer Goblin James here says it's a felony, which would be 5 to 99 years in jail.
Oh my gosh.
But anyway, it says police have contacted the persons of interest and will consider
will be considering charges soon. Oh, yeah, I'm thinking there's probably going to be charges. I also don't think they're going to do 99 years. They're probably kind of come to something that's lesser, but who knows? Maybe they've got a long history of stealing magic cards. I don't know. That's a thing. Like, I don't know if you've seen from local Facebook groups and stuff. I'm sure it's the same way around the country. Like, they go in waves, but like robbers target game stores specifically in like steal magic cards, steal Pokemon singles, steal magic singles, wow. Yu-Gi-Oh things. We've had them, I think, in the last, at least the last 2-3 years. It feels like there's been at least 2 that I remember, if not 3, and they hit. Like, they'll go around the metro and hit in the course of like a month, hit like 4 or 5 stores.
Dang.
Until they eventually get caught. It's like they do a chain.
I had no
There's
idea.
A lot of fucking money in that.
Obviously,
and it's an
yeah,
easy
yeah.
thing. It's an easy getaway. You're not going to have a bunch of cash, but like the cards are in their cases.
Yeah.
And the packs are easy. It's like you're not actually carrying a lot of shit.
Yeah.
You know? And he's like, boom, smash the door. You're typically in a strip mall or whatever. Not a ton of security. Even if it goes off, whatever. Bam, smash and grab the shit and get out. And so, yeah, that's people do that. It's just shitty, but.
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was the thing, really. I mean, obviously it makes sense because magic is so valuable and a lot of the cards are very valuable.
Yeah.
I didn't know this, but apparently Warhammer Plus is not currently available for subscribers in Canada because of an archaic legislation according to our writer Godwin James here, has to increase the Canadian content, the prominence of Canadian content in streaming services. So maybe Warhammer Plus is like, we don't want to put Canadian propaganda in Warhammer Plus. We're just going to remove the ability to subscribe to it in your nation. I have no idea that's why that happened, or no idea if I'm interpreting this Bill C-11 correctly. But that is an interesting thing that's happening right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It says they passed a law that requires bilingual language usage on all apps, and Warhammer Plus does not currently comply, meaning that the French Canadians.
I learned this when Jeremy Black Magic Craft came to visit me. All of their snacks have the English version and the French version on the packaging, because it's a requirement. It's been a requirement for a long time to support both languages. Interesting.
Sure.
Sure, bud.
Yeah. Anyway, that's pretty interesting. Speaking of Warhammer Plus, I don't know if he has it on the news or not.
Oh, yeah. The fucking vampire model?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they announced the next year's models for Warhammer Plus. One of them is a Cadian one, is the 40K one. Pretty cool looking Cadian. But surprisingly, the Age of Sigmar one is a fucking vampire. And she's a
Von Karsten.
Von Karsten.
Yeah. We're continuing the Von Karsten bloodline with a new named character. She's got 2 heads, helmeted and unhelmeted. She has the same hair as the fucking Blood Knight cavalry, where the hair is
like woo!
And I thought the Blood Knights were doing that because they were on a horse and like the wind was going through their hair. But no, she just kind of looks like I've been electrified.
I was, for the longest time, I only had seen the helmeted version, and I'm like, this model is fucking sick as long as you put a different head on it.
I know, I wasn't a huge fan of the helmet. It's fine, but
the armor is really good.
It's
though.
Really good. You need something that makes it feel like a vampire, though.
Yes.
Like, really? And yeah, the head, what do you think of the unhelmeted head?
I thought the same thing you did. I was like, why does it look like she's like riding a roller coaster? Like the hair is just like, whoa, like it's like movement.
Yeah.
When they, before they said that, I read in the article where they, before I saw it, that her head, her hair is like properly like pompous or aesthetically like very Baroque is the way I interpreted it. And so I pictured more of like the ones on the Mortis engine or the Coven throne.
Yes. With like a ruff and stuff and like, yeah. And like, or like a big poofy hair or
yes.
Like. Okay, I had the exact same experience because the writing, and I have it here, this miniature features a choice of 2 heads, one helmet with batwing motif and the other with an exaggerated aristocratic hairstyle befitting an immortal terror of the mortal realms. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. They're going to do the classic vampire heads of some kind, And no, that
head does not fit that written description whatsoever.
Yeah, it kind of doesn't. So yeah, I had the exact same experience as you did. And
we can find other vampire heads.
We can find another one. Yeah,
yeah. We have the technology.
But yeah, it's a fucking cool model. I have a buddy who has Warmer Plus, the best man for my wedding, and he is gonna pick the mini up for me because I gotta have it.
My buddy Derek is doing the same for me. Nice. He sent me out. He's like, hey, are you gonna be able to get that? I was like, I don't have Warmer Plus. He's like, I have it. I don't want it. It's yours. I'm like, fuck yeah.
Nice. God, I love people just feeding me vampire models.
I appreciate it.
Please.
I mean, that makes me so happy. There's one less thing I have to try to track down.
Yeah.
Or like fight with myself about getting Warmer Plus just for that model.
Yeah.
Or honestly, check out what's going on in there. I want to.
You can make a smear piece on it.
Yeah, I do. Get some boners over OnlyHands.
More Canadian news. As Minnesotans, we're already aware of this, but if you didn't know, Canada's on fire. It's been on fire forever. Yeah. All their fucking haze is getting down here in Minnesota. But we have some friends in Canada, notably Creature Caster in BC, who have had to evacuate their HQ because of these fires. Mm-hmm. And this is going to affect their production. So if you bought something that was like a resin cast or a physical product, you might not be getting it, or it might be delayed. So just keep that in mind when working with Creature Caster. And maybe now is when they need your support most.
Yeah, I'd say just have a little, all we need is a little patience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they're good people. They stand behind their word. They're going to get you your shit. So make sure, it might be a good time to support them and just not be something you're going to need next week.
Yeah.
But it seems like everything's okay. They got everything transferred over the staff, their warehouse, everything. Everything seems to be safe for them, so that's the good news for that update.
So Gamescom happened, and they showed off some things about Warhammer Darktide on the Xbox. Darktide is Vermintide, but the 40K version. And notably, you can play the Pyromancer class, and all the classes in Vermintide have subclasses that you can play as. So when you pick the Waywatcher, you can play as a High Elf, as a Dark Elf, as a Wood Elf when you get later into the spec tree, tech tree. And as when you play the caster, who is normally a pyromancer, you can also now spec her as a necromancer instead. So if you want to play Vermintide, you can play as a necromancer.
Dude.
That's fucking cool, dude.
Yeah, dude. I love me some necros.
Have you ever played Vermintide?
I've never played
It's a good one.
I've never played any Warhammer video game ever.
Okay, yeah. There's a lot, and a lot of them are not good. But Vermintide, I would say, Vermintide, and I enjoyed Space Marine, even though I fucking hate Space Marines. Those two I was happy that I bought.
I guess the way my tone of voice for that made it sound like I actively chose to not play Warhammer games for some reason, and that's not the case. I just never have.
What
I mean. And I've heard some of them are good.
Yeah.
So that's good to know.
Welcome to the end of the podcast. Thank you so much for hanging out with us all the way to the end, listening to us to ramble on about Canadian wildfires and Tito's vodka.
Hannah Banana.
Banana.
Some cowtails reviews. We've really spread the entire gamut. We've learned how to fix Warhammer by just playing narratively. Cooperative, competitive, we checked all those boxes.
Yes. If you like the podcast and you want to support it, there are a number of ways that you can do that. All things linked in the description below. Most notably, we have a Patreon campaign that gets you access to an extended version of the podcast wherein we discuss things like what we painted. Sorry. We don't discuss that. We discuss new things we tried out in the hobby, what we learned from those experiences, how we failed in those experiences. We discuss other hobbyists that we admire and paint jobs that they have that we have found and enjoyed in the last bye week. And we also give feedback to one of our patrons. So as a patron of the podcast, you can submit models for us to look at and give feedback to. And also as a patron, you can submit topics for us to discuss. But if you don't got any cash and you still want to support the podcast, you can also support us through other means, like sharing the podcast with other people that you think might be interested in it, your other hobbyist friends. Also, things like reviewing the podcast on Stitcher, on an Apple Podcast, on Google Podcast, giving us those good reviews also helps to spread the word, increase our what's the term?
Reach.
Yes, that's the term. All those things. And you can also watch the podcast on YouTube with our channel whitelisted through various browser add-ons if you prefer to use an ad blocker, because we play an ad every 30 minutes, and that also makes us some money too, and it costs nothing for you.
We are now off on a new grand adventure to find tendies for lunch, and we are so excited. I think I still got two cowtails left for dessert, too.
Nice.
We hope you find your tendies sometime, both physical and proverbial tendies, in the next fortnight. And until then, we will catch you on the
flippity flop.